My name is Rob Cordes. I'm with the Nebraska Commission on Public Advocacy, and I represent Mr. Saeed. And this is a second-degree murder conviction and use of a deadly weapon out of Hall County. It's a direct appeal that you've taken on a petition to bypass. At the end of the day, I'm asking you to reverse that conviction, those convictions and sentences, and remand the case for a new trial. And to get you there, I gave you 5 assignments of error, and of course here to answer any questions. But without those questions, I'll just jump into each assignment of error as the order they appear. The first assignment of error involves an invocation of the right to counsel and the right to remain silent. It appears that the state is conceding that the invocation was a valid invocation of the right to cease questioning. But if not, I would submit that the way it happened was there Miranda warnings are given during the interview, and
I beg your pardon, which date are we referring to?
Well, and that's an important question, Your Honor, thank you, because there were a number of interrogations, but only 2 of them made the jury bench or the jury trial, and so I've attacked both the April 2nd, or 20th, I'm sorry, interrogation, and then later the June 5th, although nothing much happened in the June 5th. So during the April 20th interrogation, reading the Miranda rights, the question comes, are you willing to speak with me without an attorney? And the answer is no. That's pretty clear. And then the follow-up question, which probably should not have been asked, are you willing to, you're not willing to talk to me without an attorney? And he says, no, I am not, or no, I do not want to talk to you again. So even more clarity in there. And so we get to the State versus Rogers cases. We talk about the pristine invocations. This is as pristine as any of those. So I don't think there's any question about whether or not he invoked his right to silence.
Was there some question about whether he wanted to talk about a different crime or?
Your Honor, what happened is they began the interrogation following an interrogation the day before on a different crime. And at the beginning, Mr. Saeed expressed a willingness to talk. But as soon as we get, you know, a minute and 40 seconds into the April 20th interrogation, reading the Miranda form, asking him if he waives his rights, he says, no. Are you sure? No, I do not want to talk to you. And so there was a prior within 24 hours questioning about another crime and another situation where an invocation was made. But I didn't put that in the brief. I don't think it's relevant. It wasn't part of the evidence presented to the jury in this case. And it wasn't part of the suppression ruling in respect to the April 20th interrogation.
He's in custody, is that right? I beg your pardon. Is he in custody on April 20th?
Yes, he's in the Hall County Detention Facility.
He's a pretrial detainee.
He is indeed.
For not this crime, another charge.
I can't tell you exactly what charges he was held on. He was certainly arrested for another charge and questioned on that charge. He at some point becomes arrested for these charges as well. Whether that occurred before the questioning, I don't know. But he's certainly in custody for the purposes of Miranda, whether it's invocation of the right to counsel or the right to remain silent. And again, the state doesn't contest the custody portion of this.
Would you like to discuss the harmless error argument regarding the April 20th?
Sure. And I think that's what this the first assignment of error boils down to, is whether the state can prove that it's harmless error. And I don't think they can. What you have in that April 20th interrogation is a set of falsehoods presented by Mr. Saeed. He says he wasn't even there. Well, he's on videotape there. He says he wasn't wearing a boot. The videotape shows he's wearing an orthopedic boot. He talks about other people being at a park that aren't there. He denies being at his sister, and he was, and she testifies. So you get to the harmless error question, and you ask, what's a prior fact going to do with that? What's the jury going to do with that? And it comes out as consciousness of guilt, that you did something that now you have to lie about. And what the prosecution did in this case beyond that is in closing arguments, they talk about all those things, and they talk about the letter which came in as part of the misconduct, and the cops keep talking to him, feeding him facts. He relies on those facts, writes a letter because he's scared about those facts, and he incorporates those facts in the letter, and how that letter is part of the record. So you have the falsehoods, which would never have gotten in had that interrogation been denied, and you have the consciousness of guilt. But they argue credibility, even though he didn't testify. They put up a slide in the closing arguments that talks about the credibility of Ahmed Saeed. And of course we objected, and eventually that struck, got a curative instruction as well. But that, we get to the harm of that. They're arguing that because he made these statements, he's not a credible person, he's not a believable person, likable person, what have you, but the harm is real.
Did these false statements come out in any other manner other than this April 20th statement?
No. I mean, you get the letter, and then the question is whether or not that's fruit of the poisonous tree and would have been admissible otherwise.
Let's stay on the April 20th for right now.
So to call this cumulative, I think it is unfair. It is not. This is the evidence that came in from that interrogation.
Was there other evidence about either wearing or not wearing the orthopedic boot?
Yes, there was indeed. And that's clearly on the video, Your Honor. I would like to, the time is going by, so I'm going to go to the drug question, because it's a very intriguing and it's a very fact-specific question. The person that got killed, they say, got hit by a metal stick in an alley down by the park, but he shows up five blocks later with no bleeding from the head. He's not dead. He's lying down on the sidewalk next to a place where local citizens, are hearing a dispute in the morning hours, and they find him there. And by his hand is a bottle of lorazepine, and he also has Prozac, and he has prescriptions for these things. He has appointment cards. Question that we're dealing with a current mental health condition, okay? And the questions become, can we use that at the trial? And so I ran into a situation where I had a trial judge without objections on the part of the trial, limiting my ability to question the experts about whether or not what these drugs did, what their treatments for, and very importantly, the adverse reactions of these. Because the adverse consequences of taking these drugs by themselves are in combination with the other drugs, or in combination with alcohol, are very severe, and they mimic the vomit that you see there, the unconsciousness that you see there, all adverse reactions of the drugs. And I'm not allowed to talk about it.
Your effort to get the consequences or the effects of the drugs would be useful for, is this, for example, that the victim is aggressive by virtue of this cocktail, right, and therefore was the first aggressor? Is that where this would help you?
More specifically, Your Honor, that on the objective component of the first aggressor, not the subjective component, Justice Castle, but the objective component on whether or not he was a primary aggressor or a first aggressor, it's evidence in favor of that. But it's also evidence in favor that there's an alternative cause of death, that he died from falling down those steps where his blood is located, on those steps by the apartment at 504 West.
Did the trial judge let in that component of the potential examination about how the drugs may have impacted the injuries?
No.
Did that come in?
No. And it was a cascading set of rulings. I would come in beginning one ruling, and the jury would be dismissed, and I'd be explained my ground rules for being able to talk about it, and then I'd be stopped and say, no, the ground rules don't incorporate that. You're not allowed to ask about the effects. What Justice Miller, I was allowed to ask in theory is whether or not at the hospital, whether these drugs caused him to die quicker. He had a closed head injury. The brain started to swell so much that it caused the scalp to kind of explode in a number of pieces or to break out. And I was able to ask about whether or not the drugs had an effect on that, which doesn't explain how he died the night before or the days before, whether it was from the alley. And on the other hand, the state was allowed to ask this doctor about how long a person could walk with a closed head injury, because they have the problem, they have the injury they say occurred at Pioneer Park five blocks away, and a body that isn't dead without a bleeding head wound, later on. So they had the problem, and so they were allowed to ask questions.
Mr. Cordes, could you speak more in the microphone? I think some people can't hear you back there.
I can, Your Honor. Thank you. I will not walk around. So. and so I think the Matthews case is an appropriate case for that under the way we argued it. The Trammell case, I think, is a great case as well. And under that situation, I think the remedy when you have a current mental health condition that you're not allowed to ask, whether it's because of the invocation of a privilege or what, that testimony is just not allowed. So I think that might have been a remedy in this case as well. Lastly, before I leave that, there are two things in the brief that I think are very important. One is that there's a comment that there's a videotape out there that the jury didn't get to see. That there's a portion of the videotape that's on appeal, but it shows that Mr. Saeed was walking with a metal or an object in his hand in the alley. That was certainly not anything that the jury ever saw. The state didn't ask for it to be seen by the jury or the judge, and it just wasn't. I don't think it's appropriate to use it in a brief or in an oral argument to say that that means anything. And also, in respect to the drug components, we have whether or not olazepine was in the system. I'd make maybe four or five offers of proof in this case, and I believe that in those offers of proof, I argue that antipsychotic, antidepressant drugs were present in therapeutic doses. In the autopsy report, there's two antidepressants and the anticonvulsant drug, the Keppra. And I believe the fluoxetine is clearly the Prozac, but I believe the other one is the olazepine because it's also used to treat depressants, and I can understand why somebody would take the that drug and classify it as an antidepressant instead of an antipsychotic. So I do believe that olazepine was in the gentleman's system that tied Mr. Camise. But even if not, it's in his hand at the time they find his body. He has a prescription for it. It's a current medical treatment that he's going to get. I think I was able to ask about it regardless of whether or not it shows up in the toxicology at autopsy. I am out of time. Are there any other questions, Your Honor? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Faust, good morning to you.
Morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Stacey Faust. I'm an assistant attorney general representing the appellee, the state of Nebraska. This case involves Miranda, the Fourth Amendment, and multiple rules of evidence, so I certainly see why the court picked it for the law school oral arguments today. I would like to focus your attention today on two of the issues, however, which are Saeed's statements to law enforcement, along with his jailhouse letter to his sister, and the DNA evidence. I will respond to the drug issue, should I have time, and should this court have questions for me on it. The state's overall position is that the omission of Saeed's statements on both April 20th and the afternoon of June 5th are harmless. I begin with April 20th. Miranda involves two things, custody and interrogation. And I think this goes towards Justice Miller-Lerman's question. Saeed was already in jail on April 20th on an unrelated charge.
So it's a custody of a pretrial detainee. And what's the jurisprudence on that?
Yes. There is a difference between being in custody or behind bars and Miranda custody. And the United States Supreme Court explained that in its 2012 case of House versus Fields, Miranda custody involves two-step test. And first, there is the freedom of movement test, which this court has applied on numerous circumstances in numerous cases. But then there is the second step in the analysis, and that's whether the relevant environment presents the same inherently coercive pressures as the type of station house questioning in Miranda. And in House, the court emphasized that imprisonment alone is not enough to create a custodial situation within the meaning of Miranda.
Was that decided with respect to a convicted individual?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And which was my next point, I know that House involved a prisoner serving a sentence, not a pretrial detainee like Saeed. I do not think that is a valid distinction. There are cases out there, and I've cited them in my brief, that say that's not a valid distinction because the relevant inquiry is whether that coercive station house atmosphere was indeed present during the questioning. In other words, is the suspect still under that shock of being removed from his normal everyday life? Or has jail or prison become his new normal. That inquiry applies, I think, equally to prisoners serving a sentence or to pretrial detainees.
What do you think is the best authority with respect to Miranda and the pretrial detainee?
Yes, so Justice Souter had a concurring opinion that actually it predated House, but I think it's very fitting. I think the analysis is fitting and correct. And then I cited a couple other cases in which there is a U.S. versus Harris case. It's a federal case out of Virginia, 2015, and there's the Justice Souter case was a First Circuit case just in 2010. There's state cases, Pieper versus LA, they're all cited in my brief. So I'm here today to ask this court to apply both steps in determining whether Saeed was in custody on April 20th, but I say that while also conceding that I think that you will come to the decision that he was in custody, as I have. And I say that simply because he was arrested less than 24 hours before. He was, he invoked on April 19th, and it wasn't honored. And it was the same investigator both days. So if you're looking at that relevant inquiry of was that
well,
coercive?
How can this be harmless, or at least can you respond
yes.
to Mr. Cordes's argument that the state used those statements very vigorously to attack the credibility of his client, and can you respond
yes.
to that?
I would disagree that the state used them vigorously. The state's closing was extremely brief on that issue. It's a 42-page closing. It's a 58-slide PowerPoint. It was one slide of that PowerPoint. Defense counsel objected, moved for a mistrial, and the district court provided the jury a curative instruction to telling them to specifically disregard any statements, written or spoken, concerning the credibility of witnesses who did not testify. And this court's jurisprudence is that juries are presumed to follow instructions. So in that sense, and then if you go to the actual statements himself, I think summarized, he was trying to distance himself from his altercation with the victim. We have plenty of other evidence showing the same thing. We have at least two witnesses saying that on that night they saw him, or briefly before that night, he's wearing the boot. Right after the time of the altercation, he's not. Investigator Sloan finds the boot at his sister's house, at Saeed's sister's house, concealed under the stairs. We have.
Could you clarify the video, what's in, what's out?
Yes. So Mr. Cordes is correct. The part that I have cited in my facts was not published to the jury, I don't believe. You can tell that from their question, and you can tell that from the BOE, the bill of exceptions. However, it is the entire surveillance video was entered into evidence. It's properly before this court on appeal. It's part of the facts. Simply, the reason I cited in my facts was because that part of the video makes Saeed's letter to his sister make even more sense. He asks her to go to the car lot and find out if the side camera works, and he tells her to pretend like she lives at the White House located in the alley. Because if the camera works, it's a done deal for him, since that's where it all happened. And the part of the unpublished video that I cited in my brief shows Saeed follow Kamis by this White House off the alley, and then a short time later strike an object repeatedly on the White House before discarding it and walking back towards the park. To me, it showed him almost in a blind rage. And before I saw that, and actually what also tipped me off is the allegations in Investigator Sloan's affidavit for a search warrant. He talks about this walking by this house by the alley. I thought the altercation actually occurred somewhere in the part of the alley that wasn't recorded, and that's not true. And so should this court...
What do you think that, how was the jury informed about the altercation? Where were they told it took place? on the evidence that was published.
Right. It's, like I said, it almost was conveyed like it was in this part of the alley that wasn't on the recording. The cameras didn't catch it. You have one camera facing the park, and you have one camera facing the alley. The park is in front of the car lot. The alley's in back of the car lot. And to me, it would happen over here on the side, and I think that's probably because that's where the parties exited, the view of the camera by the park. And so, to me, I thought that's where it had occurred, and that's not true. The unpublished video corresponds with Saeed's letter that it actually occurred by that White House.
If the letter were out, what's the argument?
Well, I mean, I don't think the letter is out. It's not part of the Fruit of the Poisonous Tree because he wrote it voluntarily. Nobody made him write that letter. He wrote it 9 days after the April 20th incident, and he wrote it thinking that no one but his sister was going to read it, because he says in the letter, "Don't write back to me, because they only read incoming mail, not outgoing." So the letter to me is absolutely in.
That's not the premise of the question.
Correct, Your Honor. If you don't have the letter, you have Nuri's testimony. You have the surveillance video where you see, although you don't see the actual blow, you see them in the fight, and you see Saeed. Kamis clearly exits the fight. He's walking away. Saeed goes into the middle of the road, grabs something, clearly puts it behind his back, and follows Kamis off camera. To me, that also gets rid of his self-defense claim. Saeed could have walked away at that moment. You know, when Kamis walked away, he didn't. He followed him.
He got a self-defense instruction.
He did. I would like to move on to the 20 seconds, but I would like to move on to the DNA evidence, if I may. In Johnson, this court held that statistics have to accompany DNA test results of inclusion. Otherwise, the results are irrelevant, and inconclusive results have a danger of misleading the jury. But in Johnson, it was the state who introduced the inconclusive results in its case in chief. Johnson did not speak to what we have here, which is here the state introduced the inconclusive results on cross-examination of Saeed's DNA expert, Brandy Porter. And only after the defense examined her about only two of the 12 blood stains on Kamis' jeans and sweatshirt, and about only two out of three contributors for one of those stains. And this is because Saeed was excluded as a contributor, right? So of course he wanted this evidence in. But it misled the jury to believe that Saeed couldn't have been in contact with Kamis that night, because otherwise his DNA would have been on Kamis' clothing. And that's essentially what the defense argued in closing. And to the state, that's a game changer. Saeed's selective presentation of the DNA test results opened the door to the admission of the inconclusive test results pursuant to the specific contradiction doctrine of State versus Carpenter, or pursuant to the rule of completeness under 27-106. May I continue, Chief Justice?
You may.
Almost all of the DNA mixtures detected had minor contributors with uninterpretable results, which, as the expert explained on cross, meant that she couldn't make a conclusion at all about the identity of the contributors.
So how did that help the state?
Well, as soon as the defense introduced the selective DNA test results that it wanted to introduce to say, hey, look at this potent DNA evidence. I didn't do it. I didn't have contact. I couldn't have done it. I didn't have contact with the victim. That made the state's inconclusive test results completely relevant. Say, wait a minute. You don't have the complete picture. You don't have all the DNA test results. Actually, here's everything. And while it might not have included him, it didn't exclude him either. And so these results don't exonerate him. Look at all of them. Look at the complete evidentiary picture here. I think jurors can understand this. I think when they're told inconclusive is inconclusive. I can't make a scientific conclusion. I don't think we need, I think they're allowed to hear the evidence, frankly. I think Johnson's wrong on that. I don't think they need an instruction to tell them that. I think they're smart enough to understand the testimony as it is. But to the extent to dispel any concern, in this case, there was a specific limiting instruction that told them not to speculate about the contributors to the uninterpretable results.
Did the limiting instruction sort of not allow them to consider the reason you say the state offered it in the first place? I mean, the limiting instruction says DNA testing results that are uninterpretable are not to be considered by you as evidence that anyone contributed. So how does that leave in place the purpose for which you say the state offered the evidence?
Well, I think it leaves in place of no conclusion is no conclusion while you're not to consider them as identifying anybody. You should also, I don't think it's really speaking to, it's just allowing the jury to consider everything, because the evidence that Saeed introduced was implying that he didn't do this. He's innocent. I don't think the jury instruction took away from
was
that.
Would this be a fair characterization? The limited purpose of the uninterpretable is only to say there were more DNA samples taken.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think it could be, yes.
The end.
Here's everything. But you can consider he's excluded as the defense put on for these ones, but on the ones the state presented.
And you don't challenge that?
No.
No. As a matter of advocacy, the virtue of that as defense counsel?
Yes. Yes. I don't dispute. He was fully within his right to introduce.
Was part of the defense that the state had not done a thorough job of testing all the possible testing they could do?
I think there was some testimony with regards to items found at the apartment where the victim was found that weren't sent in for testing, but that wasn't the basis of the DNA testimony, no, it wasn't. And while I understand that Justice Castle in his concurrence in State versus Johnson said, now that has opened the door, if such an attack is made, has opened the door to inconclusive test results, arguably, I think that this is even more so, where they're trying to use the DNA the DNA evidence to say, hey, look, my guy couldn't have done it. His DNA is not in the clothing.
So suppose you have video recordings from different locations, and one of which clearly shows that the defendant isn't present. But you have another video that shows a figure who you can't identify as whether it's the defendant or someone else. If the defendant presents the video that shows that he's not in the picture, mm-hmm. does that open the door to the state showing the video where someone you can't tell exactly who's in the picture?
Can the state make an arguable an argument that there are certain characteristics of that person that fit the defendant?
Well, I think my hypothetical is there any proper purpose for which this other video, where you can't tell one way or the other who the figure is, has the door been opened by the first video?
Yes.
And what's the basis for that?
Specific contradiction or rule of completeness, I would argue that.
How specific,
more specifically, specific contradiction.
I mean, how specific does the contradiction have to be? Isn't that really what we're talking about?
And in your hypo, as is here, it really the relevance is, it comes down to who did it. Like, did Saeed kill Kamis? Like, so if in your hypo in here, where they did here, they come in and say, No, he couldn't have. His DNA, look at the clothing, his DNA is not on there. Didn't have contact with him.
Was there any any assertion in connection with Ms. Porter's testimony that here are whatever 12, there are 12 DNA samples, no more, no less, and look, he's excluded? Was there some reason to have thought the jury would have the idea that this is all the DNA that was collected?
On redirect, she was asked specifically about everything, and she said she, for the scientific conclusions that she could make, all 19, Saeed's excluded. For the scientific conclusions that redirect, she could make.
But on the direct, was there some assertion this is all the DNA that was collected?
I don't think it was specifically said like that, but I think the impression was left because when we all now know the remainder of the DNA evidence is only asked about one stain, everything of one stain, and then specifically limits the testimony or questioning to contributor one and contributor two of another stain. There's a contributor three, and the reason it wasn't asked was because it's uninterpretable.
Thank you.
I'm way out of time. If this court has any questions, including about the drug issue, I will be happy to answer them. We ask you from the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cordes, we ended up giving the state a bunch more time, so we will give, is there time for a rebuttal? We'll give you 3 minutes if you want rebuttal.
I do. Thank you very much. And I got to tell you, speaking with the trial judges out there, Chief Justice, your question, and Justice Miller-Lerman, your questions about State versus Johnson are fair. I think the trial judges are worried about the situation where you have uninterpretable results, inconclusive results, and the situation about whether or not you can talk about. But to the extent that you can talk about whether or not something was submitted for testing, that's a fair question, and no one's fighting the ability to ask that question and answer it. But what we're fighting about is the heart of that Johnson case. And that's when you have a scientist that has looked at the stuff and said, I can't make a scientific finding about that. I don't know whose it is. I can't include Mr. Saeed. I can't exclude him. It's speculation as to whether or not anybody's DNA on there is on there in particular. And that's what they're talking about. When you talked about Krykmeier's testimony and Johnson, it was just inviting speculation. Hey, that could be the defendant's DNA in those minor contributors. And that's exactly what it's in the Johnson, it says, is irrelevant and highly prejudicial. And so you know what a jury is going to do. The same thing that the prosecutor is going to do. They're going to speculate with those minor contributors that we don't have any scientific. Could that be Mr. Saeed?
Could that be handled by proper instructions to the jury?
I don't think it can. I think it in this situation, and especially the way it came in this trial, basically they were allowed to go through the entire report without putting in evidence, item by item. And there were a lot of items for which there were no scientific findings. So we spent hours. And then to have that curative instruction, both at the time and afterwards, it doesn't take away the bell. It should have taken away the argument that inconclusive evidence means something from the Attorney General's office, but it didn't. You can imagine laypersons with no experience of the law, what they're going to do. They're going to come to the same suspicions about what these inconclusive results can be. And then they were clearly inconclusive results. And results for which no scientific finding can be made, irrelevant, highly prejudicial, came in. Yes, there was a limiting instruction. I argue that it wasn't enough in this case. I can understand an alternative point of view, but it is certainly not an alternative valid argument to say that evidence was rightfully before the jury in the first place. They could have heard that because who knows who those minor contributors could be to, you know, any allele that they're pointing at. In respect to to the drug issue. There were other arguments I think need to be presented. There was an argument that in addition to this video, which, comment on that video, Judge, you can't tell for sure who that other person is in that video. We can't assume that the state or the Grand Island Police Department didn't want it in there for a reason or that they didn't see it. But there's more than just one person that they're talking about there. There's a group of people that you can't identify. You can't identify whether these group of people have a common purpose, and there's no testimony ever about a group of people meeting with Mr. Camise in the alley. That just didn't get in front of the trier of fact.
Can we clarify the record real quick? Is that video in evidence but just not published? Is that the status of that video?
Justice, that's the best way of describing it, yes. I see I am out of time again. I do thank you for the extra time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is therefore adjourned, and lawyers, if you want to leave at this point in time, you may. But we will, we use this period of time at the law school to take questions from law students or anybody else, for law students, and we should tell all of the students or anybody else who asks a question, we cannot talk about the cases that were